Welcome to Breaking the Mold, exploring the people and issues fueling business today.
It's business time. It's business time. It's business. It's business time.
And now, let's break the mold.
Ooh, it's business.
Hello, Breaking the Mold listeners and viewers. Yes, viewers. Today, in a move that is only eclipsed by the live showing of Neil Armstrong walking on the moon, Breaking the Mold's episode 14 is being done live in front of a standing room only crowd at the Henry Clay Ballroom in Louisville, Kentucky.
All right.
Woo! Woo! Dan.
See, we weren't lying.
This is, okay.
That was a great sound effects record, by the way. It really sounded realistic. That's gonna be awesome.
This was live, this is real, Dan. This is how Taylor Swift feels. We are the Taylor Swift of business podcasts. That's...
Would you say that the biggest story of the year, do you think, is Taylor Swift's feud with, is there anything bigger than the Swift feud with Kanye West and Kim Kardashian?
I can't think of anything.
This year, that's gotta be number one, right?
Okay, we're here in Louisville, Kentucky. It's been in the news a lot recently related to Muhammad Ali, but of course, we are here at the invitation of Kentucky to the world as a result of our roots being in this fine town where a careful listener will know is our hometown, because we only usually mention it four times per show. We will not be deviating tonight from our format despite the live show. This is always how we conduct our business here at Breaking the Mold. Dan and I will be attacking an issue of the day, followed by our interview segment, and concluded with a wrap-up takeaway section. We're gonna probe in on our eight block, Danny, into the intersection of banking and technology. It is the hot story of the week. Amazon has announced that it is getting into the lending business directly through their Amazon Prime account. That's right, Dan, you can load up your basket, your shopping cart, sunscreen, toilet paper, and a $100,000 loan. Once Dan and I settle whether this is the right approach, we get on to what is an incredibly special honor, and that is we will invite a local and national legend, the one and only Junior Bridgman, to the stage to talk about his story from small town Indiana boy to NBA star to extraordinary businessman. But Dan, before we get started, I have a question on etiquette. At what height does someone have to disclaim the nickname of Junior? So because we're doing this live, the audience obviously can see that I'm the tallest member of the Roth family. And as that tallest member, I would say that I am still a foot shy of Junior's nose. So at what point does he start calling us Junior and we call him Sir?
I think the it's an excellent question.
Yeah.
Maybe we'll get to the bottom of that tonight. The real question is, how tall was Senior? I mean, that's what I want to find out.
That's a good question. How tall was Senior?
Here's what else I want to find out. Amazon.
Yeah.
All right, so here's the deal. Amazon has basically said if you're a student Prime member, if you're paying your $79 a year, you can now get a below market rate for a student loan.
Mm-hmm.
To me, this is the way Amazon has broken into so many other markets. They got into into TV. You know, my kids sit there and watch Amazon video all day. Amazon was not a video provider, now it is, and they did it with certain shows at the beginning, and then they kind of broke it wide open, and now they take on Netflix.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is the opening salvo in an Amazon attempt to take on banks.
I think you're right. It's not subtle. Now, it's done in a way right now, which is a lot of ways that tech companies kind of enter into new space, which is they partnered with Wells Fargo to be able to offer these loans. What I think is it's a smart move. Amazon's gonna learn on Wells Fargo about how to actually make these loans effectively, and I think Wells Fargo will be jettisoned as soon as Amazon feels they have the expertise. But it goes to a more fundamental problem that I have with tech companies overreach. Tech companies should not be issuing loans, okay? It's a question of whether banks should be issuing loans, but certainly tech companies should not be issuing loans. Tech companies, whether it be Amazon or there's an entire space, what's called peer-to-peer lending.
Right.
Right. Companies that have come out of the woodwork, social finance, probably the most famous one is Lending Club, which is now a public company. And these companies offer, outside of the standard regulatory environment that banks have to follow, is that they're able to offer loans, and in some cases, do fundamentally what a bank does, which is take deposits. And they, by the way, they take deposits without needing to have any FDIC insurance.
Right.
Which should scare anybody who's got money in any of these places. But what I think is a classic overreach by Amazon is this arrogance, this hubris, which is, yeah, we can figure out retail, why can't we figure out banking? And I think that's going to make them bad as underwriters. Underwriting mean their ability to be able to actually offer good loans,
yeah.
Which is bad if you're an Amazon shareholder. But my bigger concern is this societal one, which is why do we think we're, I feel like we're heading right back into another 2008, another financial crisis, but that's going to be started by these non-banks who are making loans to people that can't afford to pay them back at advantageous rates for now.
But could it be any worse than what the banks did in 2008? I mean, I think that this is what you have, to say that the tech companies aren't going to be able to do this because they don't have the history or the FDIC insurance, first of all, they can get that. There are regulatory means to go and get that. But what you have are people who are willing to press the limit to find new algorithms to figure out risk, who don't have the same risk models that Wall Street has that took us over the cliff. I mean, I don't think that would have actually happened. When I hear about Wall Street and innovation, I want to hide underneath my bed.
I hear you, and I think that there is limits to innovation. But I think there's also a focus on tech companies that algorithms solve all problems. And I actually think what you do is try to undermine that a little bit, which is not to say that everybody is going to determine what news they happen to consume on LinkedIn purely from a formula. So
I would say undermine's the wrong word. What we do is we build off of that. We help pop the filter bubble. But yeah, no, I understand what you're saying.
Okay, but let's just say that is the approach that they take. Okay, so what algorithm does Amazon have for determining whether somebody is creditworthy to get a loan? Well, they've got their spending, right?
Yeah, they can absolutely.
Okay, so where do you stop? Great, you've got all the spending. But now let's say I'm on Amazon, and I buy a book on treating, you know, drug addiction. Well, now that information's in Amazon's hand. Now they know that I've got an interest in drug addiction. I'm now not creditworthy. They've got a lot more of non-standard way of being able to evaluate and a violation of my privacy to know what I will or won't be able to do in terms of repaying a loan.
Right. But on the other hand, you have getting a loan is difficult and expensive and requires working in mainstream ways. It requires giving over a lot of financial information that you might not have and you might be okay getting the loan. I think that having these avenues that the tech companies pushing into this open up avenues to give people to get people access to money that they wouldn't have gotten otherwise. It means that you can be underbanked and still get loans. It means that you can find that you might not be traditionally attractive for a loan, but some algorithm says, hey, this person actually has worked this job a number of years and this does look pretty good. And while a Wall Street bank might say, forget it, this guy doesn't have enough assets, the algorithm would say, this is a totally trustworthy person. I mean, Lending Club was very similar to that. Lending Club looked at what you had to say, that I'm going to pay this back. And the algorithms would try to determine how likely you were to do it.
Lending Club's probably not the way you want to go.
Lending Club's not in great shape right now.
So Lending Club, I'm sure all of our savvy listeners, especially our urologist listeners, who are the ones who tend to email us the most in terms of feedback on the show, which is that they would ask is, okay, so what happened to Lending Club? What is Lending Club? And it is the standard bearer of this peer-to-peer lending like we talked about, who's through mismanagement, fraud, and CEO malfeasance, has gone through a period where they were the darling of Wall Street and the stock price doubled and tripled and has now cratered.
Yeah, but after the financial crisis, they were the ones who were giving money to people who actually needed it. What's going on with the business is totally separate from them destroying people's lives. They were not taking homes away from people. That wasn't going on.
But watch, it is my belief that these tech companies are going to be a problem before we realize that they're a problem, that they are going to be the too big to fail. Watch. Amazon, PayPal, you're going to see these companies that don't have any limits right now to what they can do in banking. Apple, whatever they can do in banking, like we talked about in our last podcast, what they can do, there's not going to be any limit, and then it's too late, and then I don't know how you put that genie back in the bottle.
I would still, we've seen what happens when the genie leaves the bottle, which is Wall Street today, and I would much rather have, to stretch the metaphor incredibly far, I'd rather have the genie be living with these guys and seeing what they can build and watching them compete with each other than having a few Wall Street banks controlling who gets the money and how they're doing it and extending risk way beyond what they should be doing.
All right, so just for perspective, the consumer loan business is $3.3 trillion. Okay, that's how much banks...
That's your opinion.
The entire peer-to-peer lending only did $18 billion last year. That's a smaller number than $3.3 trillion. That, if that number grows, you know, they're not really being wise. I think that it's going to be a problem. I think it'll be a major problem. And I think that there hasn't been an 08 to unearth. There actually, you've only had interest rates at essentially zero since these companies started forming. They've never been tested. And I think it's going to end badly.
All right, here's the way I see it. Love getting Amazon packages delivered every day. I love watching Go Diego Go on Amazon whenever I can. I'm ready for them. I'm ready to get loans from them.
I get Amazon. If I'm Jeff Bezos, that's exactly what I do. I get into the loaning business. You don't have to package anything. You don't have to ship anything.
Yeah.
And the margins are much better. I don't blame him for doing this.
You just think it's going to end badly.
Because it will. Okay, so we end our business topic the way we always do, which is to determine who's right or wrong. We wrestle.
Let's go.
Okay. We are at, I'm on the 103 weight class, Danny's 112 pounds, so we'll see what happens. So we, Dan, are now in for a real treat. We have to leave it there, but we are about to interview Junior Bridgman. So stay with us, Breaking the Mold fans. We can be followed at Roth Evan, at Dan Roth. We can be emailed at btmshow@icloud.com, but give us your feedback. We want to hear from you. Thank you.
You're listening to Breaking the Mold. You can follow us on Twitter at btmshow, or you can email us at btmshow@icloud.com. Now, more of Breaking the Mold.
And welcome back to Breaking the Mold. Dan, we are now joined on stage by Junior Bridgman, which we feel incredibly fortunate to have. Not just because of your celebrity status, but because you certainly have preferred to avoid the public light, and we know how rarely you've agreed to being interviewed. So thank you.
I'm not sure how I got here.
So. Too late now. For those that need the introduction, Junior was born and raised in East Chicago, Indiana, where he excelled in basketball, which eventually brought him to the University of Louisville to star for the team here. He was the 8th overall player selected in the NBA draft in 1975, and little known fact, was traded on draft day for Kareem Abdul-Jabbar.
Oh, the dude from Airplane?
Basketball player.
Oh.
No, yeah, and from Airplane, you know, from Airplane, yeah.
But it wasn't one-on-one.
It was one-for-one?
No, there were a few other players involved in that. So.
On Kareem's side.
Yeah.
Junior played his entire career for the Milwaukee Bucks, all 12 years, scored 11,000 points, and has his number retired by the Bucks. And that's where most stories stop for athletes, but Junior has defied the odds and has built a massively successful business, starting with his role as head of the NBA Players Association, then launched Bridgman Foods, which eventually grew to owning 200 Wendy's franchises, 125 Chili's, 45 Fannie Mae chocolates, and employing 9,000 people. Forbes just rated Junior as the fourth wealthiest retired athlete, the fourth wealthiest retired athlete after such no names as Michael Jordan and David Beckham, and ahead of Shaq, Jack Nicholson, and Magic Johnson.
Forbes will make a list out of anything.
Yeah, pretty
That's
much.
Just incredible.
That is true. Yeah, they'll make a list out. I don't know if I'm happy you guys brought that up, but go ahead.
We should compare notes ahead of time. Junior recently transitioned the business, which we'll talk about here. And Junior is the chair of the board of the University of Louisville. Wait a second. I'm getting something from upstairs. No, you're not the chair of the University of Louisville. Wait, no, you are.
You're not. Yeah.
You know, Junior, for a guy that really does prefer to avoid the limelight, this is not one way to do that. I know you hate publicity, but we have to ask, why did you take on the role and what's going on today with the university?
Well, how long do you have? why'd I take on the role? I got a call from the governor, and it went exactly like this. It was about 10:30. He said, I need you to help with the University of Louisville. I need you to think about being on the board. And I go, okay. He goes, and I have a press conference in a half an hour, and I'm going to announce you're on the board. So, so that's how I got there. So, but you know, I had served on the board previously for 12 years, and I told him that I had served my time. Mm-hmm. So, like a lot of people on the board, it was really just a matter of trying to help the university that had given so much to you. And even more than that, helping something that's very important to the city of Louisville. It's really important that the university is strong for everything that goes on, a lot of things that happen in the city, and a lot of things that they produce, not just great minds, great students, a lot of things. So it was important that way to try and help in some small way.
So is charity.
That's what it's in. They're not paying me, so that's what it's ended up being.
Junior, let's talk a little bit about how your career path. Certainly, and I know that you're leaving tonight after this to go to New York to talk to players about NBA players about how they should think about their life after the NBA. You're one of the great success stories of leaving the NBA and going on and doing something incredibly well in the realm of business. Would you talk about how, when you got started, when you were a kid, you weren't thinking you'd be a professional basketball player. You were thinking about studying and doing something that didn't involve the steel mills, that involved getting out of town. How much did you think about what you were going to do outside of basketball?
Well, a difference is when I, first of all, basketball was the only way I knew I was going to get to college. My father worked in a steel mill, and I knew that they were not going to be able to pay for me to get a degree. So I had to do something to have the opportunity to go to college. And growing up in East Chicago, Indiana, that's what everybody wanted to do. Everybody wanted to play basketball. And I was just fortunate that when I came along, we had a very good high school team. We went undefeated my senior year. We averaged 96 points, and we held the opposition to 60. It's amazing how I remember those statistics.
But I bet you can't remember your grandchild's birthday.
You put me on the spot, you win that too. But I was just fortunate, and then Denny Crum got the job here. He recruited another player from my high school to go to UCLA when he was assistant coach there. The freshman coach at my high school influenced me to come to Louisville, and I had great four years in college, something you don't see very often, and I was very fortunate to play in the NBA. But with that, you knew you were going to have to do something else. As we were talking earlier, when I came into the NBA, the total salary for the Milwaukee Bucks that year was $1.8 million, mm-hmm. and that was for all 12 players and the coaches. And so you came into the league with the mindset that you're going to have to do something when you stop playing, because you're not going to be able to live off whatever you can save. So I always knew I was going to have to do something.
Yeah, but that's true. But the other players weren't doing the same thing. Not everyone. You don't see everyone who was a Buck during your years going on and having the same success you've had. What do you think it is about the way you were raised, the way you were thinking, that enabled you to make that transition?
You know, we grew up, we had to work. And so I was never afraid of working, but it really wasn't something that happened when I was growing up. I'll tell you when it did happen. and collective bargaining. You talked about representing the players. So we're at a collective bargaining meeting. We're arguing with the owners over per diem. We're getting $21 a day, and we want $25. And you can't have eaten New York for $25 a day. You know, you guys know that, and you couldn't at that time. But during a break, we'd go over to our corner, and we'd talk about we got to get this or that. And I'd watch the owners, and they'd go over to their side. And so I started easing over to their side to hear what they were saying. And they weren't talking about us. They're talking about, I've got this new 500-unit apartment development going on. And true story, one of them was getting ready to promote the movie Sting. Show you how long ago that was. And they're more excited talking about business than they are basketball. I mean, how could anything be more exciting than basketball? I mean, that's just impossible. And so I said, I've got to figure out what it is that they have that they're excited about that we don't know about. And so I started to try and understand more of the business world. And Jim Fitzgerald, owner of the Bucks when I was there, we were playing Golden State that night. So we're in the hotel coffee shop in San Francisco. It was in Oakland. And he says, well, come on, sit down. So I sit down, and he says, what are you going to do when you stop playing? And I said, well, I'm going to get involved in business. And he said, well, what kind of business? I said, business. And he kind of did what you did. He chuckled. And he said, you know, wouldn't it be great if we had a copy of next year's Wall Street Journal today? And I said, they don't have a sports section. I've never read the Wall Street Journal. And I never had. I never had. And so he kind of laughed. And so I said then that there's a lot of things I have to learn. So that's what I did. I went back and I started just trying to learn from people. And I had the advantage of going around and meeting a lot of people and being involved with a lot of people. And one of the great stories I tell, true story, is meeting Sam Walton. And everybody that I met, I stole something from. Along the way. And a quick story about Sam Walton. So I was there with Sidney Moncrief, player on the team, and we were there for a charity event, and he invited us to come to Walmart the next day. And I said, so how neat is that? I get to go to Walmart to hang out with Sam Walton. And I'm thinking when I get there, I mean, his office is going to be as big as this room, and you know, people are going to be throwing rose petals on the floor when he walks and all that kind of stuff. And we get there, and his office isn't very big at all. And his office is actually pretty junky, you know, to tell you the truth. And I'm like, this doesn't make a lot of sense to me. He's the second wealthiest man in the whole world. This doesn't seem right. And he says, well, come on, take a walk with me. And we go walking through the halls of Walmart, and he knows everybody that we encounter. And not just their name, he knows something about them. And I won't tell you some of the stories he told, but I said, if I ever get involved in business, that's what I'm going to be. I'm going to know something about everybody that works for me. And it stopped when I got to about 3,000 people. I can't do that anymore. But that was my goal, to have that contact with people at work.
You seemed, understandably, very impressionable, right? That you eavesdropped on the owners and what they were doing or things that you felt maybe you should be doing. You're watching Sam and how the way he conducts business. How much of what has made you successful is taking what you've learned from others, and how much of it is just who you are?
Well, I think that if you're going to be involved in business, if you're going to be successful in anything, you have to be true to who you are. And I was fortunate that I grew up in East Chicago, Indiana, and I had two parents, and they were more concerned. They only had three rules. One, you had to go to school. You couldn't bring any bad grades home. You had to go to church. And we were in church more than I was in school most of the time. And if you went out for a sports team, you couldn't quit. And they didn't care whether you played or not, but you couldn't quit. And that was the only rules we had. And so that was the foundation of who I became. And so from that, you know, you stole things from different people along the way. You know, I will tell you that I stole things from a lot of people, a lot of great ideas, but it all had to fit with who they made you and the person you are. And when you did that and got that in, working together, then it's amazing how successful you become. Mm-hmm.
How did you, would you talk about the transition from when you retired, how you made the transition into fast food?
I was sitting around, had a friend in the banking business. It wasn't with Goldman Sachs at the time. And he was saying, well, what are you going to do when you stop playing? And I was, well, you know, I'm not sure. And he said, well, I've got a couple of friends that are Popeye's chicken franchisees, and they're getting involved with Wendy's. And maybe you ought to talk to them, and you can get involved with them. And they can make some money for you. So when you stop playing, you won't have to take the first job. And so I met them and invested with them on a Wendy's restaurant in Chicago. And so after this basketball season was over and I came to see him, I said, well, how'd we do? He said, we did $1 million in sales and we broke even. I go, okay. So went back, finished my last year playing, came back. Well, met with them again that summer. How'd we do? We did $1.1 million this year. We broke even again. Yeah, so I said, so something's not right. And not to get into the whole thing, but I had to get out of that situation. Wendy's International got involved, and that's how I got involved in Milwaukee. They said, you spent all this time in Milwaukee, why don't you get involved and went with Wendy's in Milwaukee, and we'll sell you these 5 stores. So I said, well, that sounds good. So I bought 5 stores from Wendy's International. One was doing $400,000 a year, 3 were doing $600,000, and the best store in the market was doing $800,000. And you don't make any money at those numbers. Mm-hmm. And so I'm glad my wife couldn't be here, because when I stopped playing, all the money that I had saved $750,000. And when I bought those 5 restaurants, it cost $750,000.
So your net worth is the same as Danny's.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
That's great. Yeah,
I could relate to you. Yeah. But that first year, when I forgot that it snowed in Milwaukee as much as it does, and when it snows, people don't come to eat. And so we barely made payroll. And there was a lot of time that first year when I didn't think we were going to make it. And so I was thinking that, okay, 12 years, and now you're going to be another statistic in the league.
What was that like to be? You were a star. And now you're suddenly worrying about making payroll, and you're getting the snow out of the way to go into your restaurant every day. Psychologically, how did you deal with that?
You know, to become a player, you in your mind, you somehow figure out that to get to this point, I'm going to do whatever it takes physically to get there. Mm-hmm. So you go out and you practice. And to get to the point where we could be successful, I said, what am I not doing? So I talked to some other franchisees, and I mean, I worked 18 hours in those restaurants. We fired one crew 3 times in the restaurant until we got it right. But the thing that I learned that has been kind of the secret through all these years is in Milwaukee at that time, well, the thing that I learned is it's always about people. And it's never about you. It's never about what you want, but you have to understand what that person wants, what's important to them, how do you motivate them, how do you get them to see your vision. And in Milwaukee at that time, if you got stopped for a traffic violation, they took you to jail. Boom. So most of our employees were in jail. So, so we were bailing them out. True story. I mean, so much so, we'd go down to Milwaukee County Jail. They'd say, Wendy's here, get their people ready. But what it did is it allowed the people to understand and to realize that we cared more about them than just somebody coming to work every day. And so once they understood that, then they started to say and started to believe that somebody cares about me. Maybe I can do this. And it even went to where I went to court for one of our assistant managers, a gentleman by the name of Harold. I'm gonna give you his last name, true story. Harold worked for us for 4 years, did a great job. And I get a call one day from an attorney, says, well, what are you doing next week? Can you come down and be a character witness for Harold? And I'm thinking, all right, it's a traffic violation, whatever it is, no big deal, I can do that. So I go down to Milwaukee County Courthouse, I walk in, and they say, well, okay, just have a seat here. There's cases going on, or he's in there. So I'm thinking he's inside, and they're finding him or something like that. So they said, open the door, walk in. So I walk in, and it's right out of Law and Order. I sit down, and they eventually call me up to the stand, and at that time, you had to raise your right hand and saw me swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, which I do. And I sit down, and there's a jury sitting there looking right at me. The judge is there, and I'm trying to figure out, what am I doing here? And there's the prosecutor and the defense and all of that. And Harold, before he came to work with us, had done some things that he shouldn't have been doing, involved with illegal pharmaceuticals. But I can truthfully tell them that in the 4 years that I've known him, what type of person he is and how he's worked from a crew person up to assistant manager, and he's taking care of his family and all of that. And does he get off? No, he gets probation, and he has to do some things for a while, but he is now a chef in Alabama. And so, but once the people realized what you would do for them, then they started to understand what they would do for you. And what we could do together, more importantly. And so that's how we go from 5 stores to a bigger number today in restaurants. And it was never about how much money you could make, because if it had been that, I would have done something a lot more lucrative than being in the restaurant business. Yeah. But along the way, we provided opportunities for people to better themselves, to make more money, and to make more money for them family. For their families, and it's amazing how that, when that happened, how you turn around, and all of a sudden now Forbes is writing about you saying this and that.
Did you ever think that you lost, at any point kind of as you were building your business, that you lost touch with those basic principles, that the business had gotten too big?
I don't think so. I don't think we lost that, because that became the culture of who we are. And it's and if that's your culture, if that's how you do business, then people that come to get involved with you, they either fit into the culture, or as we say, they either they assimilate or they go somewhere else. And mm-hmm. So that's kind of the type of company that we've built over all these years. And that's why the people have stayed there all that time, is because it's been we have an inverted pyramid in every office that we have, and at the top of that inverted pyramid is the customers, and right below the customers are the crew members, and all the way down, and the person at the bottom of that pyramid is me. I'm the least important person in the whole thing, and that's how we've tried to run the business. And so, yeah, they may say, well, you're the guy that signs the checks and does all those kind of things, but I can only make one hamburger at a time, and I was a lot faster a few years ago doing that. So, so it's about them. It's their company.
How much do you think of yourself as a ex NBA player, or is that something that's so far in the past that other people bring up to you all the time? Are you now business person first?
You know, that's a good question.
He asked the same thing to Donald Trump.
Did he? I'd love to know you probably asked him, what are you? And what answer did he give you right now? When I got out of basketball, everybody thought they considered you a basketball player first. And so a lot of people thought that all you knew was basketball. And it took a long time before people started to see you as something different than a basketball player. And now, if anybody remembers me as a basketball player, then I know that they got a great memory, or they're as old as I am. So, I don't know how, I don't look at myself as a basketball player, because that's like a past life. I don't know if I'd even say I look at myself as a business person, because there's a lot smarter people in the business world. I just look at myself as being very fortunate and very blessed.
Yeah. Would you talk a little bit about the transition that's going on now? What is, read a lot about it, bottling business, and is that the future? Is that a future? How did you get involved in it, and how does it play out?
And why now?
Why now? Do something else in life. No.
You ready? That was it?
No. When I looked around at And everything that you do for hopefully your family, as you guys are doing, and you do for maybe their kids down the line. And so I looked at the restaurant business and where we were today, and I said, is that sustainable? And it probably is. It may not be sustainable in the same format, same way, same brands and all that it is today, because people are still going to go out and eat. They may just change how they do that. But we're a big Coca-Cola customer. And so when I heard that they were divesting themselves of their bottling distribution business, I thought that, you know, that may be something we should look at. So 2 years ago, I started to look at that. And for a whole year, they did a lot of interview. I mean, they wanted to know about me. They wanted to know about my family. They wanted to know everything about you. And I just thought that was, you know, a little overkill, but it was important to them that they have what they consider to be someone that fits in with what they're doing. And why is that? Because in the last 40, 50 years, they've only added 3 new bottlers in the whole North America. And so we became the 3rd new bottler that they're going to have. And why is that? Because, you know, we can debate carbonated drinks, we can debate sugary drinks, we can debate all of that, whether that's good for you, but they make and sell all kind of things that most of you don't even know are made by Coca-Cola, that aren't those drinks like that. So I looked at it that at this point, if I could do that and could get something like that for the kids and the family, that would be sustainable, because there are bottlers that have been bottling Coca-Cola for over 100 years. And so I thought that if I could make that happen, that would be the thing, you know, for the family.
So you're thinking about legacy here. This is legacy, right? Passing it on.
And is that age dependent? Could you have thought of legacy 10 years ago, 20 years ago?
No, I think we were still in the somewhat of the growing mode 10, 20 years ago. And it's even funny, because when I talked to Coca-Cola at my young age today, they thought I was kind of, you're a little old to be thinking of doing something else. And so, but when I told them it was about the kids and brought the oldest son to get involved, then they looked at things differently.
How did that conversation go with you and your older son?
Oh, it went to, well, what are you doing? Nothing? Okay, this is what you're gonna start doing.
That's a short conversation. There's not a lot of back and forth.
And maybe that would have been true 15, 20 years ago, but you know, they're grown now, they're married, and so it was, it really wasn't just a conversation with him, it was one of our family meetings where we talk about everything, and so that was put on the table to see what everybody thought about it. And so if we were going to do this, someone had to make the commitment other than me, and so he was elected by the family to be the one.
We are in Kentucky. Why are you in Kentucky?
My wife's from Kentucky. No. No. When we good question. When I knew I was done playing, we looked at Chicago, because I grew up right outside Chicago. We looked at Dallas. We looked at Atlanta. We looked at 4 or 5 cities that we thought might be the place where we would want to be. And we went and visited, and we knew people in all those cities and looked at homes in every one of those cities. And it didn't feel right. And so we were in the car, and I said, well, what do you think about going to Louisville? And she said, well, remember when we got married, we were walking out of the church, and my mother came up to you and you said, now, if you don't want her, just bring her back. We'll take her, you know, like that. Which is a true story. She did say that. Yeah. So she said, well, you know, you need to bring me back to Louisville. And so I said, when we looked at the city, when we looked at the people here, when we looked at raising a family, compared to all those big major cities, Louisville was the place. And even more importantly, we had lived in LA, and my oldest son was attending one of these super accelerated schools where, you know, all the stars kids were going to, and you pay a crazy amount of money for them to go there. And we get back to Louisville, and he's behind.
Huh.
Yeah, and I started to go get my money back out there in L.A. but I mean, that just shows you that for the most part, you know, sometimes we don't know what we have here.
Right. Yeah. Well, Junior, thank you so much for sharing your time and your wisdom. Really appreciate it. You've been great. Stick around. You're going to be here for the C block where we talk about what we learned. But really thank you for opening up tonight with us.
Thank you, and thank you guys for what you do.
Thank you. Stay with us, everybody. We will be right back. Thank you, Breaking the Mold listeners.
Breaking the Mold wants your feedback. Please visit our iTunes show page and tell us what you think about the show. Now, back to your hosts.
Welcome back to our special live broadcast as we wrap up our show here tonight. Dan, let's talk about what we've learned carefully. Mm-hmm. Here's why. There's a firm, biggest hedge fund in the world, called Bridgewater, based in Connecticut. They have a corporate philosophy called radical transparency. That means that you can say anything to anyone in the company, your boss, your boss's boss, the CEO, and you can say it, and you have to say it. You can say anything as long as it's honest, and it's all recorded. We're going to practice that here tonight because we are going to make our observations with Junior sitting right next to us, giving him the chance to rebut or sit in stunned silence as we make our observations. And we actually think this is the best way for us to be able to talk through a little bit about what we've learned.
Yeah.
Dan, tell me your takeaways.
Number one, I think that, first of all, I didn't realize how short you were until I saw you next to Junior. I think that was a real eye-opener. Yeah,
but still taller than what you look like next to Junior, so how did that feel? Yeah.
I thought that it was a really fascinating look. If you think about players today who are finishing their careers with insane amounts of money, and are wondering what to do. You look at someone like Junior, who has managed to, this is super uncomfortable, has managed to, say this was just a point in my life. I was an NBA player, and now I'm doing something totally different, and that is has brought me even greater success than being one of only a handful of people to have played at the pro level. That's fascinating.
Yeah. I would say, though, when I think about people who have been incredibly successful financially, they rarely talk about that their pursuit was about money. Mm-hmm. And what I heard Junior say today was that when he was observing and trying to think about career path post an NBA career, it was the excitement the owners had, not the wealth that was accumulated on that part of the room.
Right.
And I think this kind of naive pursuit of trying to win the lottery, you know, start a tech business, you know, come up with, you know, the great idea that cures cancer. If you're doing it for financial sake, it tends to be one that at the first sign of challenge, at the first problem, at the first time that snow has, you know, banked you in and you can't open your Wendy's, you run. You try to go find something that's easier to make money.
Yeah, I'd also say that feeling that challenge of having to find something else to do is really important.
Yeah.
That this idea of this is a different time where you didn't leave with insane amounts of wealth and you had hangers-ons who were saying, I'll take 10%, I'll take 5%, give me this and that.
Yeah.
You had to figure out, there was a hunger to figure out what the transition was going to be like. That's very important.
Yeah. Also say what I found interesting is that if you ask me the five things that it takes to build a good fast food franchisee business, I wouldn't have put people in there. I would have put access to capital, expense management, you know, leverage, maybe time. But I think of fast food people as those who are replaceable.
Yep.
Right, the guy flipping the burger, there's a formula to how you flip the burger, and the next guy can come in and doing it. But to the extent that you can build loyalty, not through some pithy mission statement that kind of, you know, hangs over the men's bathroom as you walk into it about why it's so important what we're doing, but by bailing people out of jail, by actually, like, you know, caring about their life, that caring part I thought was just so interesting that it's it's relevant in everything. It's relevant in the least people type of business.
Do you feel like you're a bad boss because you have not bailed any of your employees out of jail? I'm starting to think you might be. What about takeaways from doing this live? What do you think? Should we do them only live?
I do not think that's a good idea. I think one of our observations of doing radio is that doing these podcasts is that as soon as you turn off the mic and you stop the tape, your guests open up. They relax. You see them physically relax. They literally like sit back in their chair and you hear more of, they're just off guard. And Dan and I joke that like, we just wish you kept the tape rolling and you kept the stuff afterwards and you could use that. And I think it's a credit to Junior that there was so much personal storytelling, but I think in general, it's hard to do a show where you feel like anything that you say, you can't take back.
Right. I can tell you that as a journalist, one of the great things that you do is finish the interview, you put down the notepad, and then you just start having the conversation while you leave your recorder running.
Huh.
And some of the best stuff comes from
And how do you use that?
You use it in the story, if it's still on the record.
So someone, and you're talking about me, I'm bailing people out of jail. So you
got to get the truth out somehow.
All right, so let that be the lesson of the podcast. Say it's off the record when you talk to me.
That's definitely true. That's true in life. All right.
Well. All right, special podcast. This was great. Thank you again to Kentucky to the World for extending the invite for us to be able to do this live broadcast, to Junior Bridgman for being here and spending so much quality time with us, to the city of Louisville, the state of Kentucky. Thank you for being our hometown. We'll be back with you next time, back in the studio, back in New York City.
And once to this fantastic crowd, thank you guys all so very much.
Follow us at Roth Evan. Email btmshow@icloud.com.
It's the business. It's the business time.
I don't know what you're trying to say. You're trying to say it's time for business. It's business time.
Ooh, it's the business. It's the business time.
You've been listening to Breaking the Mold. Let us know what you think of the show via Twitter at BTMShow, through email at btmshow@icloud.com, and at our iTunes show page.